Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS radio network.
With you tonight, I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers.
Dan Millman with us. He's the author of The Four Purposes of Life, Finding Meaning and Direction in a Changing World. He's the author of 17 books read by millions of people in 29 languages. He teaches worldwide, speaking to men and women from all walks of life, including leaders in the field of health, psychology, education, business, politics, sports, entertainment, and the arts. And let us say, Dan Millman, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Before we start, I think you'll appreciate this. For years on the radio, I've had this little 5x7 card in front of me. And you're going to get to guess where I got it from, okay? And the little 5x7 card in front of me said, "Where are you?" What time is it? Now.
Yeah.
What are you? I'm this moment in time, if you're ready for that.
Oh, I'm sure ready for that. That was, of course, from the
somehow
film Peaceful Warrior, based on my book.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oasis.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dan Millman with us. The book, The Four Purposes of Life, Finding Meaning and Direction in a Changing World. Dan's the author of 17 books read by millions of people in 29 languages. He teaches worldwide, speaking to men and women from all walks of life, including leaders in the fields of health, psychology, education, business, politics, sports, entertainment, and the arts. And let's say, Dan Millman, I welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. After that introduction, I should just ask if there are any questions.
I got it. One big one. When we talk about purposes in life, the four purposes, Dan, how does somebody get to a purpose? You know, we live our life and we define our life based on what's around us. But is there a purpose beyond the purpose that people normally see?
Well, in my experience, most people who ask, what's my purpose? They're thinking of their cosmic ultimate purpose here, or what work am I here to do? How am I here to serve? What is life about? It ties into many questions. But there's a kind of a chaos in this totality of our experience. It's like going through life without a map. I mean, it's the best analogy I know. And I gave a talk in the UK about 4 years ago on the four purposes of life. I don't actually recall exactly where that idea came from, but that's how all my books have come out of this mysterious place. The thing is, each of my books, and about 15 and counting, they've been a different facet of what I call a peaceful warrior's approach to living, or a piece of the puzzle. In the four purposes of life, this is the first time I really put those pieces together in a context that helps people understand the whole of their life. And I think that will become clear to your listeners as we touch upon the different purposes.
Sure. And I think the big word here, Dan, is the word recognizable. And a purpose, if you recognize what it is, then you're on the right path. It's like a question. You ask the wrong question, and you get the wrong answer for the right answer for the wrong question, and you're down a path, and you never get anywhere. But if you learn to ask the right questions, you get the right answer, and you're moving forward. And I do truly believe that a purpose has to be recognizable. And it's always deep within all of us, but it's that spark, that something that allows us to really see what it is, recognize it, and then move with it.
Exactly. You know, Lily Tomlin once said, "I always wanted to be somebody." Maybe I should have been more specific.
Loud and clear.
Yeah, And that's why I can only remind people of what they already know at deeper levels, but we often tend to forget. So I offer reminders and perspectives, and that is really the contribution that I can make in expressing them clearly enough where people really get it and can use it in daily life.
And by the way, the reminders, it's always there deep within us, no matter what it is. People say, I can't find love. Well, I just look in the mirror. All of those things are there. We have a tendency with everything going on to bury those things. And then once something comes up, and it's, let's use that word again, recognizable, that spark, that millisecond of that's it, causes us to move in the path that we were meant to move in the first place. Yeah. Now, the fundamental purposes, we have four. First one is?
Well, you know, somebody asked me, well, why four purposes, you know? Because some people might argue our sole purpose is learning to love. You know, whatever the question, love is the answer. Or maybe that spiritual awakening or someone who's religious, surrender to God is their ultimate aim. Other people would point out, wait a minute, that's all ideas. Our biological purpose is family, bonding with a mate, bearing and caring for children. That's human life, like the other animals. Still others might propose three or five or more purposes or say there are as many purposes as there are people. Yet, if we just as we divide the days of the year into four seasons and the points on a compass into four primary directions, I found these four fundamental purposes that can help us create sense of structure in the totality of our experience. And these four purposes summarize to give an overall context for people, a kind of a menu here. The first one is learning life's lessons. It's not too sexy, but there's a lot more to it than that. And the second purpose is our career and calling, what most people think of as their purpose. And I differentiate career and calling. It's important to understand the difference. And the third purpose is more mysterious. It's what I call discovering our life path or our hidden calling beneath the theater of our life, but backstage. Most people never actually clarify this without certain kind of lens or help that I provide in the third section in the book. And the fourth purpose integrates them all in a moment we can manage, which is attending to this arising moment. We can always handle this moment. And even if we don't know our cosmic purpose and all these higher ideas, we know our purpose in this moment. Your purpose and mine is very clear in this moment. So it's true for your listeners as well.
In this moment, let's go back to learning life's lessons. And I think that from my experience of life, Dan, it's one lesson after another. After you get hit with the first one and you go through it, you move beyond it, you learn whatever there is to learn, the prize at the end of the rainbow is you get to learn another one. And when we talk about learning life's lessons, it's like going through a divorce, going bankrupt, something that is horrific for you that you don't think you're going to make it through. And if you stand back and take a look at it, it's called, what are you telling yourself through the world? And I think that's how powerful we are. Nothing happens around us that we don't call to unbury, to remove those masks that we hide so we don't have to see it. So life's lessons are really what's in front of you, and I think that ties into attending to the arising moment.
Well, they do tie together, but I'd like to explain why each of them are also separate and distinct. Now, when someone hears learning life lessons, and when they hear Earth is a perfect school and daily life is our classroom, I don't think anybody's slapping their forehead going, who knew? I mean, we're all aware of the concept that we learn lessons here on Earth, but the emphasis here is that if we really come to appreciate that we're not just here for success or winning or achievement, all those things are fine, part of the game of life, but if we're actually here for learning, then as you hinted at, even a bad day at work or in a relationship or in sports or in school can be a profoundly good moment and useful moment in terms of our evolution and our growth. And I am suggesting here that we are here, it's the soul's education, so to speak. That's what we're actually here doing on the planet. The first purpose is learning life's lessons. Now, somebody might say, well, that's fine, we're here to learn, but what courses do we have to pass? Well, I give in the first purpose, as you know, I give the 12 required courses each of us is actually enrolled in, everybody in the School of Life. And it helped clarify that so we have a map and we can see, have our eyes open and shine a light in the darkness here. So that's the essence of that first section.
Yeah, and by the way, I felt for a long time is when you come onto this planet, you get your life is like a hand of cards. You know, you get dealt a hand, and how you play them is up to you. And most of us feel that, you know, the world around us, it's their fault that this happened. We're going to blame that one, and she did it to me, etc. You know, we can't stop what goes on around us, but what we can do is control how we feel about it. And that's got to be one of the major lessons in life.
Well, I would add something to that. I can't personally control how I feel about things. My emotions rise and fall and pass like the weather. I can control what I do about it. And I think that's really what you're referring to.
Same thing.
What we do in response to the moment. Life comes at us in waves. We can't control the waves or predict them, but we can learn to surf. And essentially, in the first purpose, it's involved with the idea, the school rules of the school of life are universal laws. They have nothing to do with blame or with right or wrong. In fact, you know, if somebody ignores a law of gravity, that's one of the spiritual laws. If they ignore it while climbing a mountain, it doesn't make them a bad person, but it might make them dead. So we learn through actions and consequences. And again, as you said, Jack London once said, life is not always a matter of holding good cards, but sometimes playing a tough hand well.
Yeah, there was a great quote by, who was it? John Wayne. And I'll never forget it. He said, life is tough and it's worse when you're stupid.
I got to write that down. Yeah. Okay, great.
That's a true quote.
I like that quote.
Okay. But when you talk lessons, let's go back to attending to this arising moment. Most people are 10 minutes ahead, they're 20 minutes behind, and it seems as though they have the worst time in being right now. And that's the key. And I think years ago when the movie came out, the Peaceful Warrior, there was something happened in the movie. I probably watched the movie 15 or 20 times.
Wow.
And what was key for me, which had to do with attending to this arising moment, is the lessons. And I don't have the card in front of me because I kept it for years in front of me on the when I was doing on the air. And it was always about what's the inner view about this moment in time. But it's the what time is it? It's now. Where am I? I'm here. What am I? I am this moment in time. And it's those things, those very things that if you can remember, what I've done with that over the years is when I get lost, I just tap myself. And it brings me right to centeredness and mindfulness, and then I'm back at it. It's just as simple as that to be able to achieve it.
Well, that's a good technique for remembering. And in fact, when you say you tap yourself and remember, it's not only that, it brings us back to reality because the only moment of reality is now.
Sure.
If people want to have a quiet mind, well, you know what? Whenever we think about anything, whenever our mind is busy thinking, we're thinking about something in the future or past, I can guarantee you. We're thinking about anticipating something we're going to do or it's going to happen or already happened. In the present moment is only pure awareness. What is arising? It's as if someone was talking and thinking and rambling, and I suddenly threw a ball to them and said, catch. When they turn to catch that ball, they are not thinking about what they had for breakfast, what they're going to do in the next day. They are just focusing completely on that ball. It's why we like to play frisbee and catch and do sports and play musical instruments, because it pulls us back into absorption in the moment. Now, this idea of the present moment is, again, not new. I mean, I wrote about it for years in Peaceful Warrior. It's in the movie. Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now, Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now. We have many books, and everybody knows, oh, yeah, somehow abstractly it's good to live in the present. Fact is, the past and future can be nice places to visit sometime, but we don't want to live there. And Mark Twain once said, I've had many troubles in my life, most of which never happened, because most of our troubles are these imagined or remembered things. But in the moment, we can always handle that. And I go into why our purpose in the moment is so important and so useful. Because, you know, I was a world champion athlete, but winning was never my goal. I've been pretty successful. Success has never been my goal, because we can't control whether we succeed, sink a putt, find love, win in business. All we can control is excellence in the moment, bringing our attention, quality of attention and action into each moment. And the quality of our moments become the quality of our lives. And that's a practice.
Oh, by the way, the tapping, there's another way to look at this also. Are you sitting by a desk?
Am I? Yeah.
Okay, touch the desk.
All right.
Got it? The desk just came into existence. for that moment, when you touched that desk, all of a sudden it was there. The desk wasn't even there beforehand. And I think that's what most people do. They run through life. They things are around them. You don't concentrate on them. You don't think about it. But the moment that you touch it and you put your mind on it, it brings you into existence. A touch on the chest brings you to right now, and you can concentrate. That's mindfulness. That's true mindfulness, Dan.
Hey, that's good advice. I'm going to have to touch my wife more.
And she'll love it, I'm sure. But that's not, and I say that in a respectful way, because when you think about it, if you walk over there and you intentionally touch her, not just touch her, intentionally touch her, you've put her into existence.
No, I agree. I wasn't making light of it. That's a very, very nice approach. And you were quite right. I was focused on our conversation and my notepad. And when you said touch that desk did have a different quality of attention about it. I put my full attention on it. I think that's an excellent approach. Very simple.
Yeah, you know,
I like simple, powerful practices.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to, very important now, finding your career and calling. There are so many people that are bogged down with their daily routines. They're afraid to look, and there's an old adage, what is it? Better unhappy than unsure. And people are frightened to death of what they consider the unknown.
Right. The devil we know, the devil we don't know.
Yes.
So that's very true. You know, and I remind people, you have to, if you want to swim across the pool, you have to let go of one side to reach the other. And this is one of the major areas of search in people's lives. The two most important decisions we ever make in life is our choice of spouse and career or work that we do. By the way, Socrates, not my old mentor, but the ancient Greek, once said, by all means marry. He said, if you choose well, you'll be happy. If you don't, you'll become a philosopher. So, but that's one very important choice, and career as well. And that's why career and calling is the second purpose in the four purposes of life. It's the one we most often think about. What am I here to do? The main issue of career and calling, first of all, understanding that our career primarily is there to produce income. We may like a lot of things about our career. It may be meaningful to us. It may serve other people. That's all great. But if we didn't make any money at it, we'd probably have to look for something else. Whereas a calling is something we not only want to do, but we need to do. We love to do. It's a passion. It's an interest. It can be anything from a hobby or avocation to a higher calling in the clergy or military or philanthropic organizations. But it's something that we would do for free, and often we do for free. It doesn't depend on income. Some people, like myself, their calling and career have merged into one. That's not necessarily better than someone who has a career that they like and function well at, and then they have a calling that they do in their discretionary time. So I tell stories in the book about career and calling and the variety of approaches for people to understand and trust their path in this arena. But the difficulty with finding the right career, and there's so many books on that, you know, it requires a certain degree of self-knowledge. And the trying 20s, through that second decade of life, we call them the trying 20s because in your 20s you try this, then you try that. Very few people can predict what they're going to be doing for a living based on their college major. So we kind of, by a winding path, we find our way to whatever we do for a career and finding our calling as well. But self-knowledge is key. And in the book, in the four purposes, I give ways to help know ourselves. In fact, the third purpose really helps amp up our self-knowledge and insight so we can make better informed decisions. There's even a little exercise in, so to speak, time travel, using our imagination to make better informed decisions, calling upon the subconscious mind to help with these decisions that we make about career and calling.
And realistically, when it comes down to it, if you don't call on your subconscious, that's the one that's going to drive you anyway. And then you wake up one day and you say, oh, how'd I get here? And you were driven there because it showed you the path to get there, and you weren't even consciously aware of it. So you got two fields of strength working for you, your conscious mind, which is your reason, your logic, your willpower, and that unconscious mind. That's the one that's unconscious, that's activity, unconscious unconsciousness in the waking state, and that's what causes you to do most of what you do. That's the one that's going to protect you no matter what you do. So it's always there, even though we don't think about it.
Yes, it is. It's like the right and left brain. I mean, there's nothing wrong with logic and reason, but the left brain isn't terribly good at making decisions. All it can do is weigh variables, pros and cons, ins and outs, and it can be paralysis by analysis. So We've all had the experience of making a logical decision, and then we wake up the next morning with a funny feeling about it. It just doesn't sit right. I would listen to that, because call it our inner knower. There are things we know that we don't know we know. So that's why, in fact, one of the 12 required courses in the School of Life, back to the first purpose, is trust your intuition, going into how powerful that is, and it's a different way of moving through life. Sensing, feeling, and intuiting can guide us very well in ways, and it has to do with trust and faith as well. By the way, I would define faith, F-A-I-T-H, as the courage to live as if everything that happens is for our highest good and learning. Notice I didn't ask for any belief there. I just said it's the courage to live as if everything.
It's your belief that gets you in trouble. And I really believe that. It's the beliefs that get you in trouble. Most people run through life with a belief that someone told them this is how it is. They have they create an assumption. The assumption has an incontestable conclusion. They take it on as fact, and they're running through their life in a non-reality state. So absolutely, the difference between faith and belief, big difference.
Well, that's why Lao Tzu said, as soon as you have a thought, laugh at it. Because these stories we tell ourselves, these beliefs we have, they may be correct, maybe not. They don't always reflect reality. You know, people are entitled to their own beliefs and opinions and faith. They're not entitled to their own facts. And that is where sometimes today there's a certain movement almost back to superstition where people believe whatever they want to believe, whether it's supported in reality. And it's important to get in touch with how things actually work. It's an extremely valuable life skill rather than I just believe this or I believe that. And it's important to test it against reality. For some of us, reality checks in the mail. So a sense of discernment and a sense of clarity are valuable life skills.
No question. Dan Millman, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, you can. And my event schedule information about the book, even a life purpose calculator people can use on their own right at the website is peacefulwarrior.com.
Love every second of it. Dan Millman, thank you so much. And I still love the movie. Every time it comes on, I watch it.
I'm delighted to hear it. Well, thanks for having me on.
Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. If there's a subject that you'd like to hear addressed on the show or someone who you would love to hear interviewed, contact Radio Susie. You can find her right on the homepage of the website. And you can find all of our guests on the guest page of the website, just in case you missed the name of a book, a website, or any contact information.
Sure, who would have told you they would give you the world for a toy? All I have are these arms to enfold you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Matt Whitfield with us, features editor from Yahoo Entertainment section. Hey, Matt, how are you? We didn't get Matt. Matt, are you there? Matt's not there.
I am here. I'm here.
Oh, there you are. You were hiding.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. By the way, Susie she's jumping on that microphone. She can't wait to get on. That was kind of an interesting last Dancing with the Stars.
It definitely was. I mean, the person with the lowest number of votes, which was Kendra Wilkinson, she didn't go home, and boxer Sugar Ray did, even though he was not the worst of the week.
What do you think caused that? Was that politics in any way, shape, or form, or was it the vote from outside?
I definitely think it was the vote from outside. Sugar Ray has been out of the spotlight for many, many years, and Kendra has only seen her star grow over the past 2 and 3 years based on her reality TV shows, Her reality show on E! Right now is actually one of the top-rated programs on that channel. So I definitely think it's because more people picked up the phone and voted for Kendra.
And what does that tell us? We better pick up the phone.
Exactly. If you want your favorite person to continue on in the competition, you need to pick up that phone and vote. We saw it, you know, last week on American Idol, where Pia Toscano went home and she was one of the front runners. You need to pick up the phone if you care a lot about a certain person on the show.
It was so incredible that Kendra even got that she wasn't even in jeopardy.
You know, Kendra's time on the show is limited at this point. She'll be lucky to survive another week or two, but I actually thought, despite the fact that she got the worst votes this week, that she was better than Sugar Ray. I think that Sugar Ray's score was slightly inflated for his Viennese waltz, and I actually thought it was his time to go.
Well, I think we will see. I think Kendra should, next week should be the last time. I mean,
Kendra definitely is in jeopardy next week, especially when you look at the other people that are still in the competition. I mean, the majority of them have been delivering better performances than many people expected, and
yes,
their scores are all quite often a lot higher than Kendra's. So the only other person that might be in jeopardy next week is Chris Jericho, the WWE star.
I agree. In fact, I took the six remaining couples. And my prediction, for whatever that's worth, is that either Kendra or Chris will go next week, and whichever one doesn't will go the following week.
That's probably the case. The only other wrench that could be thrown in there is if Chelsea and Mark mess up. A few weeks ago, the judges were not feeling their jive. Chelsea obviously has redeemed herself in the past few weeks, especially, you know, the other night. So unless she has a major slip-up, I don't think that she is going to be in jeopardy. And I'm going to have to agree with you. It's really going to be between Chris and Kendra.
I think so. Going back to Chelsea for a minute, I think she is the best out there. I cannot believe they were in jeopardy. And I think maybe they were only because they've been a little unconventional.
Right. You know, obviously, Len is not a fan of any bizarre tricks out there. And again, that has nothing to do with Chelsea's dancing skills and abilities.
Yes.
It has more to do with Mark's choreography. And I think that's where the judges have penalized her. They were really upset with Mark. So I do think that she has a shot to go very, very far in the competition. It's just a matter of them winning over the judges more so than winning over the audience.
And I was watching the judges' faces at the end, and I think they were even a little horrified over the fact that with Chelsea that they were in jeopardy.
Well, you know, the judges,
even,
I agree with some of them some weeks, and other weeks I completely disagree with them. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not the biggest Carrie Ann Inaba fan. I don't like the way that she spoke to Kendra this week. I don't like the way that she's spoken to Max in the past, but I definitely wasn't surprised to see them horrified by the fact that, you know, Kendra was going home. I mean, everybody kind of knew, by the fact that Sugar Ray was going home, everybody knew that Kendra was kind of going to be in jeopardy there. But, you know, the judges have their own opinions, and a lot of times the audience disagrees with them. I mean, you've had to disagree with them in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, moving on to just another couple, I love Himes. I think he's great.
You know, I did a lot of interviews leading up to this season, and I said, Himes, it's going to be all about him connecting with the audience because, yes, he's on the Pittsburgh Steelers. They've won multiple championships, but, you know, he's not as big of a...
But, wait, the Green Bay Packers took the Super Bowl.
It's true, but, I mean, Himes is not nearly as big of a star as past male athletes like Apollo, Anton Ono, or Evan Lysacek, some of those like big name stars. So I thought that he was going to be a little bit in jeopardy, but he is the judge's favorite. He seems to be the audience's favorite, and I definitely think that he's going to the final four, if not the final two.
I agree. And you know what's so great about him is that at the end of his dancing, he has this huge smile, and he just captivates you.
He definitely does. I mean, his personality is starting to show through. When you see the little packages, the intros to their dances, he really does have a great personality. He's definitely clicking with his partner, Kim, who is having her best season ever as well. So I definitely think that Hines is the front runner at this point. I mean, Ralph Macchio is still doing a great job, and his partner, Karina, is just amazing. But at this point, I think I put Hines a little bit above Ralph.
I agree with you, but let's talk about Ralph for a second. I mean, the biggest criticism they seem to have about him was the use of his hands, and so he improved.
You know, I thought that they actually delivered the best performance of the week. I actually loved that it was classical week. I was very impressed with the 46-piece orchestra, rock violinist with Katherine Jenkins. I mean, I thought they were all fantastic. And when Ralph and Karina stepped out there and did the Romeo and Juliet waltz, I was thoroughly, thoroughly impressed. I know that Chelsea and Mark had a higher score, but Ralph was the winner of the week for me.
Yeah, and by the way, Karina's getting her own publicity in other ways.
Yes, she definitely is. So it'll be interesting to see if that help or hurts their team going forward.
Right. It should be irrelevant. However, you cannot overlook it.
No, you can't overlook that. And again, this show is one of the most popular shows in TV. So, you know, whenever there's any news about any of the professional dancers or the celebrity contestants, they spike in Yahoo search and everybody is involved and everybody cares about this because, look, 20 million people tune into this show.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I'd like to make a comment on Romeo.
Yes.
I like Romeo. I loved his paso doble. I thought he should deserve higher scores.
I absolutely agree with you. That was the best start to a show this season. And the fact that he only got a 23, it blew my mind. And again, I just mentioned, I'm not a huge fan of Carrie Ann Inaba's, and she gave them a 7. I thought he was going to get 9s across the board.
I thought so too, Matt. I was totally shocked.
I mean, the audience was on their feet. Romeo was connecting with the audience. You know, he kicked it up 2 notches this week, not just 1, and he really proved that he's going for the title. Like, he is really in the mix.
He's in it. Absolutely. And then what can we say about
Kirstie? What did you think of the whole Kirstie shoe scandal? Do you think that the costumer has it out for her? I personally just think it was a flub, and, you know, they've been very unlucky 2 weeks in a row.
I'm with you. Nothing could be worse than losing your shoe. And thank God she got it on. And the show goes on. And if it were me, I would have just left the shoe out and danced with one dance shoe and barefoot.
She was lucky that at that point during the dance, she was supposed to be on the floor. And she had a few seconds there to squeeze her foot back in that shoe. And I was just, you could see the terror in her eyes. And I'm so glad that she was able to pull it together. Granted, they got some pretty low scores this week, their lowest so far this season, but they still pulled off a 22, and I still am rooting for Kirstie and Max to do well in the next week.
All right. Well, Matt, we'll see you again next week.
No,
and Michael would like to add
We need a website.
You can find all of my content across Yahoo's entertainment sites, and you can also find me on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Wonderful. Hey, thanks for being. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Matt.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return here, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Now that's all. Now that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time to never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in
once more. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
And that was that. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we're going to bring you the best, absolutely the best and the brightest of the people that are out there with the experts in their particular fields and those answers that you need to hear. We should have Dr. Larry McCleary with us. He's the author of Feed Your Brain, Lose Your Belly, and the Brain Trust Program. He's the medical director for the Shining Stars Foundation for Children with Cancer and Other Illnesses. He's also been a guest on NPR and has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, and many, many other newspapers. And let us say, Larry, are you here?
I am.
Oh, wonderful. By the way, thank you for coming back with us. You know, when we talk about feed your brain, lose your belly, there's so many people who are dieting today. Nothing seems to work. Larry, where is this? What's that missing link for most people?
Well, I think that they're told not to eat certain things. They're told they can't eat this, they can't eat that, they have to eat fewer calories. And I think that that's, as soon as you tell someone they can't do something, they want to do it. And that makes sticking to the regimen, the diet plan, the recommendations very difficult.
Now, by the way, I think that if you were to chain up somebody's refrigerator, you would find out what all their stuff is about food. And you're right. The minute you deny, it causes people to want even more. Now, the brain in and of itself, does the brain get hungry?
Well, I think that's something that we all need to understand, and I think that that's where food addictions, cravings, and any thoughts about food come from, because they are thoughts, and there are appetite centers that send out the feed me signals, and those all come from the brain. So I think that that has to be at the crosshairs in any discussion about dieting and weight loss.
Now, when we're talking about the brain in and of itself, are there chemicals, are there hormones, are there things that come into play when we feel hungry? Are there certain chemicals released that say, you're hungry, eat? And are there certain chemicals released that say, you're full?
Absolutely. And those are all generated within the brain, but they respond to metabolic signals, which are signals generated in the body, transmitted to the brain, that cause certain chemicals to be released by brain cells, and that sends messages to other parts of the brain that tell us, I'm hungry, I want this, I want a donut or whatever, or I can't wait till I get home, I've got to stop halfway at my favorite food store.
Now, can you cause, and I'm going to use the word disconnect, can you disconnect those chemicals, those hormones that create that hunger within us?
Well, I think what you can do is if you make the right food choices, you don't trigger those centers from firing to turn on those signals. And that really, I think, is the best way to approach this very difficult problem.
Yeah, you know, when people, and I've talked to people that are on weight loss programs for years and years, you know, thank goodness they've never had the problem. But all the people that I've talked to over the years, they'll say, well, I'm on this diet and I can't lose weight. And there's a combination of things that you have to do if you're going to lose weight. And I think is take the word diet and throw it out the window and replace it with the word nutrition. And that's what we were touching on.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think if you eat foods that have a high nutrient density, that are chock full of healthy ingredients, those are the types of things that are most satisfying to our bodies and to our brains. And I think that what we have to do to be successful at losing weight is really to substitute for some of the calories we would eat, the fat energy stored in our fat cells. And that's why I focus on the brain-belly connection and foods that release fat from fat cells. And if you make food choices that do that, two things happen. Number one, you naturally are not hungry. And number two, you're tapping into the fat stores, which we all have and carry around with us. And that's what you have to do to be successful.
And now, by the way, Larry, I spent, 23 years in the interior of Alaska. I was up in Fairbanks. But if you go deeper into Alaska and you get around some of the villages there, there's something called muktuk. Muktuk is fat, and it's whale blubber. And what they do during the 40 and 50 below zero weather, they eat a lot of this to protect themselves. They want to store that fat in the body. And I believe the body in and of itself is going to protect itself. If you have an emotional problem, if you have a physical problem, if that brain knows it has to do everything that it can do to protect you, I think that in and of itself will cause storage in those fat cells.
Well, I think, it's interesting. The high-fat diet that you were talking about, I think that's one type of high-fat diet. But fat, we're all aware of the glycemic index and all the diets based on it. And they're saying, well, we should eat food that has a glycemic index of, say, under 50, because that triggers a lower fat storage signal in the body. Well, fat, whether it's brain healthy or trans fat or any other type of fat, has a glycemic index of zero. So it really does very little to trigger the fat storage signal. But if you combine that benefit with fats that are healthy for the brain, you're going to think sharper, and it's going to suppress appetite, so you're not dwelling on food all of the time. And I think there are a lot of people who are emotional eaters or stress eaters, and this would really help them out.
By the way, there was a word that we used about 8 or 9 times since we started, and that's an interesting word because it may be the key to everything we're talking about with the brain. The word signal, 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 and that's really what this is all about. It is the brain signaling based on what it thinks that you need to survive.
Absolutely. And the brain, this is interesting because the brain cannot store energy. So when its fuel tank gets low, a red flag goes up, and that's what drives this whole thing. So if you can eat foods that provide continuous energy to the brain's not going to get hungry, and we're not going to overeat. And that happens to us, actually. We eat a meal, and we don't eat 24/7. We eat discrete meals every day. So when we eat a meal, our body uses the energy in the food that it needs at the time, and it stores the rest in fat cells. And that's normal. And if in between meals, when we need the calories and we're not eating, the fat cells release that food energy, then we don't get hungry and we can stay thin. But what happens if you make the wrong food choices is the fat cells hang on to the fat and they don't want to release it when they need to. That's when the brain gets nervous, turns on our hunger signals, and we end up overeating even before we've used the calories from the prior meal. That's what gets us into trouble.
Right, and I think that's key, what you just said, before we've used the calories up from the prior meal. Most people don't use those calories up. Most people are not exercising. They're not. We live in such a fast-paced, microwavable world right now, and with the Blackberries and the texting and the rest of it. Larry, we don't move like we used to move, and that's dangerous for most people.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that has to be underlined. Our bodies were made to move, and when we don't move, all of the systems in our bodies get sluggish and not very responsive. If we exercise, which is just really movement, it keeps us in touch with the signals our body's generating, and we can tell, are we hungry or are we just thinking about food and we're not hungry at all? And I think exercising is good for the heart, the lungs, but it also keeps us in touch with these metabolic signals, and that's key in maintaining a healthy weight.
And I think a lot of people, when you hear the word exercise, you think that you're going to go to the gym and start, bench pressing 500 pounds. That is not exercising. Exercising can be a walk around the block, can't it?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You don't need a gym membership. You don't need special shoes. You don't need Lycra or anything like that. If you, even in the house, if you run up and down stairs or if you walk around the block, about a half hour three times a week of brisk walking is good for the body, and they've shown now that it's actually good for brain health, and it improves memory. So it's just getting out and moving comfortably.
Now, by the way, from what I understand, and I'm not a clinician, so please stop me if I'm wrong here, but in the last maybe, let's call it 10, 15 years, the scientists, the medical profession, they're beginning to realize how important brain chemistry is in our everyday interactions in our life. It affects everything that we do, and I'm going to use that word signal again. It signals. The minute it signals, the brain chemistry changes, and based on that change, you're going to have a reaction in the body.
That's absolutely true, and there is a field now that's really starting to take off in brain science, and that's called neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity, it means how the brain rewires itself. It's a living organ, and it changes the way nerve cells connect to each other based upon our experiences and even our thoughts. And that's all based on signaling and chemicals in the brain. And it can affect us, it can make us feel depressed or happy, but our lifestyle choices can make the brain happy, and it can make it feel better, more satisfied, and it really boils down to how nerve cells talk to each other.
And that's really what it is, how the nerve cells talk to each other, and they're neurons, nerve cells, they're specialized cells, and they play key roles in transmitting and broadcasting information from one neuron to another. And all of these things are going on 24 hours a day, even when we're asleep, and we haven't realized it before, but more and more we're beginning to understand it, and it has to do with weight loss, it has to do with so many things in our life, even having try this one out. We have heard that old adage that laughter is the best medicine. Well, when we laugh, the brain releases endorphins, makes you feel good, calms you down. And when you hear something that you think will fix a problem or is going to be good for you, all of a sudden you start to feel better. A smile will change brain chemistry.
There's no question about it. That's just an example of how thinking a happy thought, being a person who looks at the world, as they say, through rose-colored glasses or the glasses half full. If you take that approach, all of those compounds, those neurotransmitters, endorphins, serotonin, and dopamine, the feel-good neurotransmitters in the brain, they make us feel better, and you know what? They decrease stress. And stress is bad because it kills memory, it kills brain cells, and it makes us sick. It makes us have high blood pressure, and frankly, it's a contributor to the obesity epidemic. So I think laughing and feeling good about yourself is absolutely critical.
And absolutely, and the way the brain works also, if you want to move a muscle, the brain sends an impulse over the nerves, and then the muscle contracts. So realistically, what you feed that brain is going to be the result and effect of everything you do in every facet of your life. You've got voluntary and involuntary parts of that brain, conscious and subconscious. And once you begin to realize that it's there and how that affects your brain and how your brain affects your body, and that's going to change everything in your entire life or keep it the way it is.
Well, and as you said, it depends in a large degree on what you eat. And it's interesting because the brain is a fat organ more than any other organ in the body, the heart, the lungs, the kidneys. We are all fat heads, and two-thirds of the ingredients or the makeup of the brain is fat. And where do you get those fats? Many of them you need in the diet. And if you're eating an unhealthy diet, meaning you're not taking in brain-healthy foods, they'll be used to build an unhealthy brain that doesn't think right and that it actually, frankly, ages more rapidly. So your brain health as well as your body health is totally under your control.
Now, by the way, in the book itself, Feed Your Brain, Lose Your Belly, is there a list of foods that are brain foods?
There are a number of lists and discussions about brain healthy foods in the book, and they consist of healthy fats, and all of these brain healthy fats are very delicate and they can be damaged by free radicals or stress or an improper diet, and so you also have to eat compounds to protect them. And where do you get those? You get those from brightly colored fruits and vegetables. So if you just remember those one or two things, you'll be eating a brain and body healthy diet.
But also, let's talk about supplements just for a moment. You know, the food that we eat, for the most part, by the time it gets to the dinner table, it's lost a percentage of the nutrients. Then if you have a digestion problem, it's going to lose even more. So what is your feeling about supplementation?
Well, I think it depends on the individual, but broadly speaking, I think if you look, as you were saying, at the soil that the foods that we're eating is being grown in, it doesn't have the nutrients it did, or it has all kinds of chemicals that have been added, or the food has been improperly preserved or prepared, so you're really not getting the full bounty of the nutrients that you should in the food that you're eating. And I think even kids, especially kids, because they tend not to think of diet, they think they're indestructible, so they don't look at the implications of the food choices they make. I think everybody probably should be taking a multivite, because in the nutritional studies that I've read, most people only take in about 50%, 100% of half of the nutrients that we need every day in our diet. So a multivite is pretty inexpensive, and it's like an insurance policy. And then over and above that, if you're taking medications, if you're old, if you're having hormonal changes, then I think specific nutrients might play a bigger role.
All right, now specific nutrients, does that come through blood testing, your analysis? How do we find out? I come to you as a medical doctor, as a physician, a clinician, and how are we going to tell what I have too much of or not enough of?
Well, there are a number of ways to do that. For some nutrients that are in the food, like vitamin A or C or E or B vitamins, you can do a blood test and measure in the blood what the levels are. Now, that works for some of the nutrients that are important, but other ones you might need to do more sophisticated testing for, because they don't really live in the bloodstream. They might live in a cell membrane. So how do you determine those? Well, there are different ways to do that. One, you can do a hair sample that can look at nutrients or toxic nutrients even. Another thing's called a biopsy of a red blood cell, which again is a blood test, but instead of just measuring the nutrients in the water part of the blood, they actually do special testing to look at how many omega-3 fatty acids of various types you have, how many monounsaturated fats. And what's important is that the red blood cell membranes reflect what's going on within the brain or the heart, so they're a good indicator of what's going on in the body. So those are the three or four ways to test for various nutrients in the body.
Now, by the way, is there a website that we, Larry, that we can find you at?
You can go to www.drmccleary.com, and that's drmccleary, MCCLEARY.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, we can get the book there?
You can get the book there. It's in bookstores everywhere. You can order it on Amazon.
Wonderful. Hey, Dr. Larry McCleary, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Michael. Have a good evening.
You too. Good night.
Bye. Whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do,
Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Yes, and I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Marshall will be with us. She's an author, she's a speaker, and she's the president of Executive Advisor LLC. It's an independent consulting firm founded around 1997. Specializes in leadership development, executive effectiveness. She's been assisting leaders in public and private sector industry, nonprofit agencies, public education for nearly 30 years now, and her work is dedicated to building strong leaders who in turn create successful organizations, transform school systems, and she does that worldwide, develops leaders at all levels, and through her workshops or seminars, personal coaching, Susan focuses on the fundamental skills of critical thinking, decisiveness, clarity of communication, integrity of word, and act, and consistency, very important word. And her book, How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, has been translated into multiple different languages and especially popular in Asia. And I'm going to take a shot and say, Susan, are you there?
Hello, Michael Ray.
Oh, there you are. Hooray for us. How are you?
I'm fabulous. Thank you. How are you?
Wonderful. By the way, there's a word that most people have no idea what it is. They think there is until they're stood up against the wall. And that word is called confidence. That's a very interesting.
Confidence.
Yes.
Boy, don't we need a whole lot more of that in our world.
But what is that? They may not like me. They may not like what I have to say. They may think I'm dumb looking. What can I do?
Well, you know what?
I get in life, right?
Here's a funny thing. Yeah. We live in an other-driven world, and while it is very important to look for feedback and watch for feedback so we have an idea of how we're being perceived, what others think of you really doesn't matter.
It's true.
When you have confidence. And it's interesting. I'm listening to all of the noise in our world today and everybody yakking away and people arguing with each other and just the cacophony of what's going on. People are really struggling with the whole notion of confidence. And really, it's kind of like, you know, when, what was the name of the movie, when Mary got her groove back or whatever it was called, people have lost their mojo.
Stella.
And they're really struggling to get it back.
Yeah, wait, Susan, it was Stella.
Stella
got her groove, yeah.
There you go.
I never watched it, but I saw it advertised a ton of times.
Yeah. But it's amazing to me that people have really lost so much of their own confidence. And one of the things that they're struggling most with right this very minute, and I'm getting calls all the time, can you come speak to us about this, is time management. And as I listen to what people ask me for, in fact, I was with a young professionals group today, what they're saying is, we have no control. Our bosses, you know, tell us do this, do that. They change their mind 50 times. You know, our parents tell us what to do. Our spouses tell us we're new parents. We have no control over our time. And that's false. But it takes an act of real courage to stand back. And one of the things we've been talking about a lot is take a time out.
Yeah.
And as we think about this and slow everything down, you start thinking about the importance of taking time out to reestablish or even build your confidence. When you can say to this crazy, mixed up, noisy world, go away from me. I'm taking a time out for 24 hours. No computers, no TV, no newspapers, and even suggesting that. People free.
Well, I have a quick question.
Yeah,
can I take a pill with that?
No.
No. Okay.
No. No pills. Right. See, that's, no. But that's what we do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a pain pill. I'm going to take a tranquilizer. I'm going to have another drink. I'm going to, you know, eat a 10-pound bag of peanut M&Ms. Whatever. We are self-medicating whenever ways we can, desperately trying to get ourselves to an even plane when so much around us feels out of control, when the best, the most effective, and maybe the biggest act of courage is to disengage.
Yeah.
But I might miss something.
Yeah.
Count your blessings.
Did you hear that phone ring a second ago?
No.
There it was again.
Oh, there it is. Yep.
Can you hear it?
Are you going to answer it?
No, it's the White House. You're telling people to be independent. They don't like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Disengage. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Shoot the phone.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to hunt you down. You know what? Bring it. And
yeah.
And this is the false fear, right? And the media is full of stories of catastrophe. Oh my goodness. If we don't raise the debt ceiling limit, our economy is going to crash. Your life as you know it is going to be absolutely over. Stop it.
You know, by the way, they go beyond that, and I think where they really go is this, that they get it to a point where whoever the proverbial they is, they get it to a point where people don't understand. If you ask me right now how many zeros are in a trillion, I couldn't tell you.
I couldn't tell you either.
Yeah, most people have no idea what that is.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. Well, and we get so sensitized to the, you know, the circus-like media, and he said, you know, who said what to whom, and oh, my, can you believe it, and what did he look like, and what was she wearing, and oh my goodness, and it's superficial silliness, and we're losing the ability to decide what's important and what's not because it's all so hypered, and we're constantly revved up, and pretty yeah. soon we don't even know what we think about stuff because we're just we're constantly responding, and we were talking today about the tyranny of technology. Because our technologies enable us to respond instantaneously, we feel obligated to do so. Well,
sure.
I know myself that when I shoot from the hip or shoot from my fingertips in an immediate response to an email, I often think, you know, gosh, I wish I had waited 30 seconds. I would have phrased it differently. I would have, you know, responded differently. I maybe would have taken a completely different position on this issue, but because we're flogged into responding. No, we're not.
Well, but we believe we are. You know, that happened to me 2 days ago. There was an email that came through that just, whatever it did, it triggered what I don't like inside, right? And I
yep.
started, I sat down and I started to respond and I thought, take a breath. And I walked
yep.
around the house and I came back and I sat down and I sent a completely different email.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
look at the strength that took. We don't think of it in terms of confidence and strength and, you know, all of those kinds of things. But in fact, it is. Because it's easier to be swept along a wave of hysteria and find somebody we like in that wave and stand next or, you know, glom onto them and say, I'm going with you because if you think this is right, this is what. And our confidence is eroded when we do that.
Sure.
When we can stop and say, you know what, I need 10 seconds to think about this. I can't talk to you about this right now, and wouldn't we live in a much more civil world if this happened? I can't talk to you about this right now. I'm confused. I'm upset. I need, let's take a 15-minute break and come back to this. And, you know, marriage counselors since the Fred Flintstone age have been recommending this. But it takes tremendous strength to stop yourself in mid-reaction and to feel the discomfort of disengaging, feeling that anxiety. We don't want to feel the anxiety. We don't want to feel like we're keeping someone waiting, or if we don't say something immediately, that person is going to characterize us as unintelligent or unthinking or not informed or whatever that is. And we see it, you know, we tend to come back in our discussions here to the political arena, but it's a good environment to make these points. Candidates often will, you know, put their talking points out there so their opponents do not define them. Think about that. for individuals, sure, when you live around that all of the time, we are so anxious to not have somebody else define us that we keep moving.
We're being defined all day long. If you're a Republican, you're a baby killer, you kill women, mm-hmm, and all the other things that happen. You know, and if you're the other side, you know, there's a myriad of things that you're called. Labels.
Right.
Labels are so critical because they drive people to prove that they're not. And that in and
That's
of itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and take that to a broader, you know, broader experience, particularly in business. If that is what's happening on one side of an issue or not, we need a new telephone system or we need new computer systems. And, you know, this is a supplier that I like and that's a supplier that you know. Now we're either or, and we're not listening and we're not learning. And in fact, when you peel all of that noise and you know, activity away, we're looking at two people who are not terribly confident in their position. Because when you're confident, you can allow other people to blow out all of their stuff and let all of the noise quiet down. And then you can say, I've got something for everybody here to think about. I've got
the best compliment that anybody can give anybody. The best compliment is, you know, the one thing that we have in common is we both like you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. If you don't like yourself, you're not going to be confident. If you're not, if you don't have that with inside of you, you're going to fall apart in front of somebody out there. You want to call me a name? I'm good at whatever that name is.
That's exactly right, and I think that's why this whole idea of taking a time out now, practicing in little ways to take the time out to regather your thoughts. And actually, one of the things that I'm recommending that people that I work with do is literally to take that 24-hour moratorium from any news whatsoever. And in fact, when they're, you know, interacting with family and friends, to be an observer and to listen, to not have a point of view, to not have a response. And I ask them to take a journal, not an iPad, not a laptop, literally a journal and a pen, to write down what they're feeling. And it is really remarkable when you look at the pushback. Some people get angry. There's huge levels of anxiety that come out. And what happens in conversations after they do this is, you know what, I had no idea. I was so strung out. I was talking with an admissions person at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and she was telling me that their admissions for anxiety and depression are skyrocketing, and not just among adults, but among adolescents. This noise, this constant running mock to with your hair on fire, people don't know who they are after a while.
But you know why? Do you know the why of this? Because we're told to be like that.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, we are. And if you don't run at that pace, and if you don't have an opinion, when I pick a subject, by the way, and lob it at you with no preparation, if you can't speak, you're deficient.
Yeah.
Well, let's be deficient for a little while and gather our thoughts and really sort of take a self-inventory of what is it I believe and what is it I think and what are my values, and when I confront these people coming at me on TV or over the internet, however I get my news and information, I now am equipped to take that information and say, you know what? Huh. I agree with that point of view. Or, no, you know what? My experience tells me that's not true. And I'll tell you what, as we ramp up into the silly season before the next presidential election, we've got to be teaching people how to do this so that they can reclaim their confidence, so that they can make a sober, considered decision about who they want leading this country into the next, you know, four-year cycle.
Sure.
And I really, I have just such a strong sense as I talk to people that we are desperately in need of a period of sobriety, to slow down, to think it through, to really sit with each other and say, what do we think about this? Instead, we're running off to rallies, and we're busing people, and we're running around with placards, and we're whipping up the frenzy, and nobody really feels deep down the confidence. That's not true. Many people do feel the confidence, and that's why they're doing what they do. But for the most part, people who are not actively engaged are just frenzied.
You know, I really wonder how many people going through those, you know, especially in Madison and then in Ohio and in D.C. when they're going through those demonstrations, I wonder if they really know what it is they're demonstrating about. And in my heart of hearts, the way I would love to see things run, if by chance we get leaders in there, people who are concerned about the people of the country and not themselves, I'd like to see them come to the table values neutral. You're not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican.
Right.
Reverse it. Neither carries the baggage that's attacked. We're here to do construction because most debates are about right and wrong. So we build from here. You leave the gotchas at the door instead of embellishing on all those old ideas. You create a workable standard to live by, something that works, not at the expense of someone else. That would give us a viable starting point. You know, it's not a be-all, end-all, but it's a beginning. It's a place to start from.
And think about the Herculean effort and the extraordinary courage that would take of a politician to do that, to lay down the arms, to be the first to be vulnerable, so to speak. Well, you know, the vultures would come in, tear that person to shreds, you know, open the closet, pull out all of the past and go, oh, my God, look at this. Deficient. I maintain, and I think you and I have talked about this, any human being who would volunteer to run for office, why you would anymore, I don't know, but has to get comfortable being stripped bare.
Yeah.
And if we can find people who say, you know what, that's true, yes, I did, okay, I was an idiot, what have you, that was then, this is now. I want to talk about now and tomorrow. That would be the kind of leadership that we're looking for. And frankly, I think that this country is starving for.
Let me tell you what's lacking.
Yes. Yeah. Pardon me?
There's a definition that most people haven't glommed onto. And let me tell you what's lacking right now. And you and I might have talked about this before. There's a difference between being dumb and being stupid. Dumb is when you do something and you don't know any better. Stupid is when you do something and you know better. And a lot of what they're doing is stupid. They know better, and they're moving toward a certain ideology, a certain end result. That's not being dumb. I can be dumb all day long. Stupid, I'll never be.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. And even in that simple illustration, there are people who will scream dumb and stupid, not understanding what they're saying. Listen to your definition, get confused, and scream louder.
Sure.
And I think that's where we're at, because people are, well, they're whipped into a frenzy. And truly, the true confidence is becoming more and more a rarity at a time when that's what we need to be helping people discover.
Yeah, there was a John Wayne. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, John Wayne.
Now, there's a John Wayne quote, and I used it at the very beginning of the show today, but it's apropos now. He said, life is tough, but it's worse when you're stupid.
there's that willfulness, you know, about stupid that you described is frustrating, certainly, when people see it, but we don't have to respond to it. And this is where, and people argue vehemently with me about this, Michael Ray. They say, no, if you don't put your point of view out there, they're going to run over the top of you. Okay. And then when they run over the top and they're gone, and people are exhausted hearing that nonsense, here's a quieter space that feels safe, that we can have a conversation about what really is going on. And you look at the difference in presentation of Paul Ryan and, you know, Barack Obama. Their mannerisms are different. Their styles are different. There's no shouting from Ryan's, and he really, frankly, doesn't care. In fact, I think he invites people to attack his ideas. He wants the conversation. He's not looking to make Paul Ryan, you know, the American Idol. So we think about style and mannerisms, and again, the whole notion that you know, the word that you introduced to start our conversation, confidence. The C word is what we are desperately in search of. That's not braggadocio. That's not, you know, the arrogant presentation of, hey, am I cool or what? No, it's really being centered in who you are and what you know and what you bring to contribute to this whole thing. Without taking a time out once in a while, you don't have time to gather your thoughts. And you really don't know when you're in this morass of activity and, you know, noise and frenzy. It's hard. If you don't know who you are, it's hard to stand still in that, to stand for something. And that's, I think, what we're seeing is a lot of people, you know, running and talking fast. But really, when you scratch the surface, the confidence, not so sure. Well, and in my mind, and I have to be careful here, because when you're a hammer, everything you see looks like a nail. But if you think about what's happening in the budget debates and dialogue, there's the confidence of doing the right thing for this nation and our people takes a backseat to winning for the party.
That's oh, by the way, I completely agree. There was one time that I would say that I'm a Republican. I became a Republican during the Clinton administration. But at this stage of the game, I don't know what I am. There's things on both sides that they're nuts.
Exactly.
And they have no idea. There's no concept of what the constituency wants. There's no concept of what the average person is looking for. And the more gas goes up and the more things that they do, I mean, look at oil. Two places we could get oil from right now. How about one? Israel is untapped for oil.
Yeah.
Our own country is untapped for oil. But do we do anything about it? No.
Well, it gets real complicated real fast.
But it shouldn't be complicated.
Yeah. Well, right. You know, what you said about the average citizen, the average person, the average person, and I have to be careful because I'm speaking from the people that I see and interact with, are more and more upset, approaching being frightened, and not feeling in control of anything. But the fact is, they are in control of the decisions they make every single day about their lives. Let's assume that gloom and doom happens, the U.S. economy crashes. Does that mean that families are suddenly, by tomorrow morning, going to go bankrupt? No.
And see, here's the other side of this. There's the other side of this, and this is interesting. They talk about an 8 to 10% average unemployment rate. What about the 90% of the people who are employed?
Exactly.
We don't talk about that. There's still money out there, but they don't talk about that. You know,
there are still people making investments. There are still people discovering new things. But it doesn't serve whoever they are, as you said earlier, it doesn't serve their purposes to emphasize those kinds of things. Well, news is not about good news. It's about, you know, the, oh my gosh, what's
it's
going on?
There's a blur.
Advertising. Yeah.
There's a blur between news and entertainment, and it's a strong blur, and it's very confusing to most people. You don't hear about the good things. All you hear about is somebody dying. And I really believe I'm going to turn the TV off the next time I hear a reporter that when someone's family dies and they walk up to that person, they say, well, how do you feel about it?
Yeah.
It's at that stage of the game that I have to think, okay, amateur, go away. How do you ask somebody that?
Exactly. And yet that's what we've allowed ourselves to become. That's what too many of us have gone along with because we're just not sure. To your point, the blur, we're not sure where the lines are anymore. Yeah. And, you know, if we were to be honest, we'd say, you know what, I have sort of a morbid curiosity. I really do want to know how they feel. There's such a thing as privacy. There's such a thing as respect for others that, you know, we've more and more we're forgetting about. And in the process, we're all losing our confidence and wondering what the heck's going to happen to us. Time out.
There we go. I'm going to go take a time out. You know what? It's wonderful having you on. And again, I'm going to sit here next week till you come back.
Awesome.
Okay. Website we can find you.
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Wonderful. And we will see you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
And if there's a subject you'd like to hear addressed on the show, or someone maybe you'd like to hear interviewed, contact Radio Suzy. You can find it right on the homepage of the website. Shawn Edgington is back with us, and she's been interviewed on dozens of TV and radio shows, including Fox Business, CBS Radio, Fox Radio. She's the author of Texting, Facebook, and Social Media. And she's with us tonight. And let's say, Shawn, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael Ray.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Shawn, when we deal with texting and et cetera, you know, we have such high technology today, but there is a dangerous side of it, isn't there?
There sure is. And, you know, it's my job to help parents understand what their kids are dealing with and really be proactive and help them defend against it. I mean, I know personally what it feels like. My 16-year-old daughter went through a very bad situation when she, you know, about a year and a half ago, where she was physically stalked and threatened on Facebook and by text message. And, you know, we're still going through the wrath and the aftermath from that event. And it's been, you know, 19 months, 20 months. So, you know, it's my goal to help, you know, share everything I've learned and experienced with parents so that they don't have to go through what I did.
No, absolutely. I remember there was a time, years, 150 years ago when I was a kid, and if there was a bully, you know, that you'd get beat up and that was the end of it, and they never talked to you again. They already did their job. But today, you can't run home. You can't lock the door and say, they can't get me now. They can get you in the bathroom. They can get you in the bedroom. They can get you anywhere they want to. There's nowhere to hide as long as you have a computer or a BlackBerry with you.
Right. And now what's happening is the use of technology is now the precursor for bullies to reach out and, you know, target their prey. And like you said, they can do it at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, and they can do it 100 times an hour. And, you know, there's, unless we show our kids and provide them with the tools that they need to know how to use to combat this, they're absolutely at risk.
You know, Shawn, there's one thing I do not understand, and I will never understand, and I can't relate to it, is if you got angry at someone, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But there are people, and we've seen it on television, there are people who have driven people to suicide with what we're talking about here, the issue at hand on the table here tonight. And at the same time, once they're buried, they're standing across the street, and they're either holding up signs or they're giving them nasty looks, and they're glad it happened. They're proud of themselves.
Yeah, I really have a hard time understanding why. It's the same thing with those bystanders where kids are just sitting there watching someone get beat up and video recording it and then throwing it up onto YouTube or onto Facebook. Or, you know, they're watching on Facebook, they're watching someone get ridiculed and completely destroyed and in a forum, and they're not doing anything about it. I'm not really sure what's happening, but for some reason kids are joining in and watching, and they're not reporting it. They're not helping their fellow student out at all.
And that's why I think your book is so important, The Parent's Guide to Texting, Facebook, and Social Media. They've got to be aware. You know, there's a lot of parents who do not have that technical, that know-how to be able to deal with all of this.
No, and the rest of the title is Understanding the Benefits and Dangers of Parenting in a Digital World. And I have to say that, you know, I live in Silicon Valley, which is, we've got some pretty savvy parents around here where they're pretty technically savvy. But it's not really the savviness. It's the fact that we can't keep up with it, and our kids are so much more advanced than us. You know, they can, in second grade, they can do a PowerPoint and design a web page now. And, you know, that's why I wrote this book, was because it just came out actually 2 weeks ago. And it's the reason why I wrote this book, is because I feel like we don't need to know everything, that's for sure. We just need to know some key things, and we need to know what to do proactively. I want to prevent this stuff from happening in our home, not deal with it after it's already occurring.
And very important is to understand the consequence of some of this. You know, there was a time where a bully was a bully, but I'm going to bring it to today. A bully can also mean the end result. The result and effect of that bullying can end up in death. It can end up in suicide. It was the kid within the last 3 or 4 months, happened to have been a gay kid, and he get an affair in college with somebody, and they took a picture of it and ran it all over the place, and the kid committed suicide. That's not fair.
Right. No. And some people will say life isn't fair, but it's way worse than that. It's wrong, really wrong. And we as parents are ultimately responsible for what our kids are doing online. And for some reason, we haven't taken that responsibility. You know, I think it's not really, we don't want to. I think we just don't think that it is really that big of an issue. We play light of it. And, you know, I did. My daughter got a Facebook account when she was 15, and, you know, I didn't go through the proactive steps I should have gone through to walk her through what do you do when this happens, and what are the steps you take, and I should have done that. And I should have sat down with her and told her what the consequences were going to be if anything went sideways, you know, because we have almost half of our teens admit to being bullied, you know, online using technology. And so what that tells me is that there's kids out there that are doing the bullying too.
Yeah.
Not just the people that are, you know, the targets. So how are we dealing with that? And how is that happening underneath our watch as parents?
Now, and by the way, there's some power in that bullying they control. There's a definition that we came up with the show before this one. And basically, there's definitions. You have to change those definitions. And the difference between dumb and stupid. Dumb is when you do something and you don't know any better. Stupid is when you do something and you know better than to do it. And I think that line is crossed with some of these kids that post the nude cell phone pictures of themselves. They are opening themselves up for blackmail, for bullying, for all kinds of things, and they don't get it.
Well, and they also, you know, if it's the definition of, you know, a child pornographer and, you know, having to register yourself as a sex offender occurs from minor to minor. So you wouldn't think that's the case, but if you're under 18 and your child forwards a sex message, they are now a child pornographer. And they also, if a judge finds them guilty, and they will require them to register as a sex offender. And this is permanent and serious stuff we're talking about here. And, you know, it is nothing to be taken lightly. In fact, today there was just a lawsuit filed for the little girl Hope, 13, in Florida, where she committed suicide as a result back in 2009 of being having a sext being forwarded out, which is also, by the way, a form of cyberbullying, but being forwarded out to a bunch of people. And she ended up committing suicide as a result of this whole situation. And the parents have filed a lawsuit against the school, actually, because she went to the counselor for help, and the counselor never went to the parents and never disclosed anything to the parents that this had occurred, and that, you know, that she had gone for help and that she basically could be suicidal. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really pushing for is I really do feel that schools should be required to notify parents if our kids come in and ask for help, if they're getting bullied using technology or anything. I think we need to be notified as parents, because it's a fact that if our kids are being attacked using technology, anything, a sexting incident comes up, they will, the majority, the big majority of kids will not tell their parents. We will be the last to know.
Yeah, and then when we really come down to it, what do we do? Let's say, hypothetically, I was the parent of a teenager. What do I do? What kind of measures can I take to prevent this kind of bullying online?
I thought you would never ask. The first, I mean, I have...
Why don't you ask that question? I know.
Yeah, I have a lot of steps, but the first, I'm going to go through the key steps, and that is to establish rules. First and foremost, and that is sit down with your kids and outline the rules of engagement for, you know, when they're using a cell phone or they're using an internet, basically social networking. And they need to agree with your rules and sign an agreement. And, you know, I have that agreement for you if anyone wants that. My website, www.digitalworld101.com. I've got a bunch of parent resources that are free. But that's huge. And the agreement is great because it goes through all the things your kids can and can't do using the internet and using their cell phone. And a lot of those things you wouldn't have thought to say you can and can't do these things. But, you know, from experience and research and surveys and interviews and everything else, I've covered the bases for you. So it makes it really easy. And then the other thing, too, is parents don't realize that Facebook has an age restriction of 13 years old. Do not allow your kids that are 10, 9, 10, 11, 12 to have a Facebook account. And then also, just because they're 13 doesn't mean they're ready to have a Facebook account. It's very, you know, at that young age, these kids are really mean and ruthless online. For some reason, they think that it's not like face-to-face, and they just say and do anything.
But they don't get it. That's why, Sean, that's the problem. They don't get it. They're not mature enough to understand what they're doing.
And that's exactly the case. But then you have parents don't even know that Facebook has this 13-year-old age requirement, and that's because of the maturity level and responsibility that is needed, and sometimes 13 isn't going to cut it either. The other thing is that if you have a 10, 11, 12-year-old that has a cell phone, just disable their MMS feature, which will stop them from being able to send a photo or a video. They don't need that capability. Every cell phone just about that you buy now has that feature. Disable it. It's free to disable. You just call your wireless company like AT&T, and they'll disable it for you. Invest in parental controls. This is the one thing I should have done. And that is a service that allows you to really set text boundaries and really manage how your kids are using texting. But also it allows your kids to really block someone who's offending them using text. And without that service, you cannot block a texter. And it's if my daughter would have had this service, she would have been able to block thousands of text messages that were coming in from five girls. Check privacy settings online and make sure that your kids have got their privacy settings set to private. You know, more and more, I see these kids that have public settings where online predators can find their profile and get in there and pretend to be someone that they are not. They set up a picture that looks like it's a 14, 15-year-old boy or a girl, and it's not that person. So, you know, just know these things are happening. And then really important is to monitor who your friends are connected to online. So look at their friends. Make sure they really know them in real life. Tina Meyer wrote the foreword to my book, and she's the woman whose daughter, Megan Meyer, committed suicide as a result of their 47-year-old neighbor set up a fake profile pretending to be a 14-year-old boy. And she abused Megan to the point where she committed suicide. And the woman was a mom. So
yeah,
you must...
That, yeah.
Yeah, you must know who your kids are connected to. You never know who's behind that profile. You need to make sure they really do exist. I have more, but...
Okay, no, I'm listening.
That could be enough.
You know, if I ever have kids again, you're right. I'll know what not to do. But when you really come down to it, I want to go back to the five girls with thousands of text messages.
Yep.
What's the dynamic? What causes this in the first place? You know, there's a viciousness that goes on today that I don't relate to. You know, there was the old days, if a couple of kids got into a fight, somebody get a bloody nose, you became best friends and it was over with. Now they come by your house with automatic weapons and they shoot. I don't understand the violence that somehow this culture, this society's created today.
Well, remember, you're a man. And, you know, we're better off as doing it the way you do it, which is usually physical and it's face-to-face and it's confrontational and it's over and then you move on. Whereas, you know, girls tend to be more drama, gossip, jealous, he said, she said, she's still my boyfriend, you know, or she likes the boy I like. And they're very vicious, like you said. And, you know, that is my daughter. These girls accused my daughter of telling on them. They came to school drunk the first day of school, their senior year, and they were expelled because it was their third or fourth offense. And, you know, these girls were not someone Nicole hang out with, but Nicole was straight-A student body officer, a leadership kid for 4 years, had 50 best friends, in the, you know, social circles, good kid. And, you know, they didn't like that, and they took it out on her. They basically blamed her for tattling on them to the principal, which wasn't the case. But that didn't matter. And, you know, I blew it because I did not go to the police. I didn't take it as seriously as I should have. They were physically threatening her, and they were following her and stalking her. And I should have gone to the police and gotten a restraining order because, come to find out, one of these girls, the ringleader, she is known for beating up girls. She's, you know, she already has another restraining order on her from beating up another girl who was, you know, a sophomore. So, she, you know, this, I should have really done more. And I can tell you that's one of my tips, is that if your kid ever is a victim here, police take this very seriously now because they know what can happen. There's been too many cases, and so go to the police and get that restraining order. You know,
but Sean, we should say thank you to them. You know why?
Why?
Did you hear that? Because you wouldn't be here right now. The book wouldn't be out. How many kids are going to get saved because of this?
I know. I mean, that is really the whole reason why the genesis behind writing this book is because I felt like my information was just too important, and I needed to get out there and help the youth, help parents, help counselors, help anyone who cares about their kids and the safety of their kids. And let me tell you, they are all on the internet. They are all in social networks. I mean, nowadays, kids of 8 years old are getting cell phones. But parents don't realize that they have to disconnect that MMS feature. And they have to teach them, you know, and they want to make sure they're not connected to the internet. And they've got to teach them all these bad things that are happening. Because I had a parent reach out to me and say, my 8-year-old daughter got a sext request from an 8-year-old boy in her class. How does that happen?
How do you respond?
How does that happen? I mean, she came home and said, what is this? You know, and give her 2 more years, she wouldn't have came home and told her parents. She just didn't know what it was. And clearly the little boy must have an older sibling or someone who's teaching him these things at the age of 8. But, you know, you used to talk to your kids about sex, drugs, and alcohol. And, you know, you used to probably start at that around 11 or 12 or 13 years old. And nowadays we have to talk about sex, drugs, and alcohol and technology at a much younger age because of what they're learning and, you know, what's going on in our world.
Sean, I wouldn't even know how to respond to a lot of this. It's gone absolutely wild. You get to a point now as a parent, and you say to your kid at night, you restrict them for some reason or another, and then when you get up for breakfast in the morning, there's the kid and their attorney. I mean, there's no way you're going to work your way through this today. You're hamstrung. You got your hands tied behind your back, and you've got agencies that are standing up for the right of free speech for these kids to be able to do this.
Yeah.
And yet once it happens, then then everything comes tumbling down and falling apart. So in essence,
right,
it's a real interesting catch-22, you know, damned if you do and damned if you don't. So that said, I really believe that a tremendous amount of people should pick up the Parents Guide to Texting, Facebook, and social media. Because of it, they might save their kids from something that they didn't have to happen to them.
Right. And, you know, fine, they can have their free speech all they want, and, you know, but I am really about parents teaching their kids about, you know, on, you know, their reputation management and their online reputation and image, because, you know, if your kids are saying the wrong things up there and you don't know anything about it, first of all, when they want to, let's say they want to get a job or they want to apply for college, guess what? All of us employers, including my company as well, we're using Facebook as an HR tool to do background checks. So are coaches now, so are, admission counselors. And, you know, if nothing else, we've got to care about what our kids are saying online, because once they post a comment, a photo, a video, it's pretty hard to take it down 100% because the information just travels from one page to the next, and you can't take it down someone else's profile.
We should sell T-shirts, and the T-shirts should say, "Free speech ain't free."
Yeah, it sure isn't free. My, Sandra, I want to do. I practice safe text. T-shirts.
we're just about out of time, so the website we can find you at and find the book.
So Amazon or Barnes & Noble has the book, The Parents Guide to Texting, Facebook, and Social Media. And you can also go to my website for some free resources. The book is also there. It's going to take you to Amazon or Barnes & Noble as well. But that is www.digitalworld101.com.
Hey, Sean Marie Edgington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was great, as usual.
Oh, good night.
Good night.
That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Well, Marla Majewski with us. She is the author of the new book, The Girl I Used to Know, How to Find Yourself Again and Put Personal Priority Back in Your To-Do List. She's the founder of Inspire Empire Company, a creator of a 10-week motivational program with the same title as her book. She's also a life coach and a motivational speaker. And Marla, hi, welcome back. Welcome to the show. Not back to the show.
Good evening. How are you?
Yeah. I am good, and how are you? And thank you so much for being here. Marla, the girl I used to know, how many women today get lost in whatever's going on in their life, and they just get distance from that person who they really are?
Well, so many of us. I mean, it's a personal journey for me, but hundreds of and thousands of women experience the same thing when we're juggling, you know, changing from going from a career to a focusing on family, and also when we get just lost in the shuffle of financial obligations and juggling more family obligations and household obligations. And sometimes we just don't realize that we're changing and that we've just put less and less on our to-do list that have to do with ourselves.
And there's that insanity of life, that fast pace. Everybody goes everywhere. You got to do everything, and you've got all these responsibilities. And one day you wake up and you realize 10, 15 years pass by, and you don't know where you were.
Exactly. I was in the Starbucks the other day, and I ran into a woman who had a newborn baby, and I asked her if it was her first baby. And she said, no, it was her three-month-old was her fourth baby. And she said, I said, wow, how old are your other children? And she said, well, 11, 7, four. And so I thought, wow, I was imagining a diaper bag for the last 11 years. And
sure.
I said, wow, that's a long time to be in the baby phase. And she said an interesting thing. She said, I don't know who I am after I no longer have a baby.
Interesting.
And when
point.
You think of that comment, a lot of women feel that they just put their identity on hold or away for a while when we change our focus to our children.
Or transfer to. The identity now is with the children, and God forbid something happened to her kids, who and where and what would she be?
Exactly. A lot of times my name isn't Marla, it's Amelia's mom or Mackenzie's mom or Cohen's mom. And so a lot of times our identity is automatically transferred to get the role that we play, not really the qualities that make us a good mom or a good professional or a good whatever it is that we're doing.
Marla, where was it for you? When did that light bulb go off and you say, whoops, what's going on here? I'm not myself. I don't even know where myself is anymore.
Well, I think for me, I had the perfect storm. I gave up a professional career because my husband changed jobs, which made us move to a new country, a new city. I was 8.5 months pregnant with my second child, and I was basically like put into a new community, not knowing any friends, not having any support around me, not having my career, which was a huge thing for me, and dealing with a newborn child and a 2-year-old toddler. And all of a sudden, I was sitting in the middle of my living room, and, you know, I'm a little teapot is singing in the background, and I'm still in my maternity pajamas with my child being 3 months old still, and thinking, wow, I feel like Swiss cheese. I have no idea who I am.
Where do you start, though? And I know that's that proverbial question, where do you start? Where is that point where you can put your foot on that path of coming back to yourself? It's not that you were never yourself. You lose yourself and all of these things, and at the same time, there's got to be homeostasis. There's got to be some kind of a balance to still be mom and still be, you know, the CEO of whatever, and at the same time, keeping you inside.
Exactly. A lot of times, we have so much noise in our life, mental noise, the stuff that's in our head, our to-do list of all the things that we're thinking that we have to get done, and also the physical clutter, especially when we have family. It's not just us that are creating the chaos around us. It's 3 or 4 or 2 or 1 other little beings that are creating physical noise for us. And so a lot of times we don't really realize that this chaos, we think that it's just kind of become our normal state and that it's not a situational thing. We never think that that chapter is ever going to end. And so when we don't know that there's an ending in it, we kind of feel like it's all-consuming and that any kind of personal priority that we have is sort of on hold or shelved for some sort of future date.
You know, unless you're, Marla, unless you're aware of it, it can last a lifetime. And before you know it, you're, you know, 70, 80 years old, and you turn around and say, where'd it go? And you cannot recapture it.
Exactly. A lot of people don't really realize that if we don't start putting personal things in our life, even when we have a busy and hectic lifestyle, we have this huge syndrome when our children go away to college or, you know, chapters in our lives change, like we get a divorce or our children don't need us as much anymore or our job becomes a little less demanding. And then all of a sudden we are at an identity crisis where we're like, oh, who am I and what am I doing and, you know, where is me in my life? And we find out that we may not necessarily be unhappy with our life. We just may be unhappy with ourselves in our life.
That's a good point. And it's to make that distinction. And life is really about distinction. Life can run, you could run through life and it could be totally blurred. But the minute you start to make distinctions, then all of a sudden things start to define themselves and they get clear. And the minute that they start to get clear, then you could take a step forward with it.
Right. A lot of times we don't know how to even articulate the life that we want because we're so busy. And, you know, we are just going through a to-do list that, you know, our Costco runs and grocery shopping and a never-ending monotonous routine of everyday life. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't even really realize that they're in the humdrum of life and that there is something more. And a lot of times when we're in this sort of crazy, chaotic lifestyle, we don't really think that there's a possibility for us to have anything more because we feel like our life is full of stuff. Maybe not the right stuff, but just too full of stuff. And, you know, I'll tell you a personal story. We went to the rodeo last year with my 3 kids and my husband, and the kids were so excited that they could go and ride the bumper cars. And so my 2 daughters went in one car, my son went in the other. And the ride turned on, and they moved about one, 2 feet. And at the end of the ride, they were absolutely frustrated. And so they wanted to go and try the ride again. My son was with my husband, and so I leaned down to my oldest daughter and I said, look for the space and move toward it. And so they got in their cars again, and the ride turned on, and my son, still frustrated, at the end of the ride, he'd only moved 2.5 feet. My daughter, on the other hand, she moved across the whole one side and back again. My husband said, what did you say to her? And I said, look for the space and move toward it. And a lot of times we don't actually look for the space in our lives and move toward it when we're thinking how busy we are and how crazy our life has become. But when you actually look in your calendar and you can see a space and define it as sacred space that you would have something personal that you'd really want to work on, or something that's kind of preventative medicine for you that really prevents you from reaching burnout, if you find that space and move toward it, then all of a sudden you have this time in your life and space in your schedule that really has an opportunity to create personal priority for you.
Now, by the way, everything that you're talking about was in a movie some years back. It was Jack Nicholson about Schmidt, and it was about somebody. Did you see the movie?
No.
Oh, okay. But everything you're talking about was in the movie. He was an executive. He was a manager for a company, and then he retired. The moment that he retired, Marla, he didn't have anything. His identity was left. He had no idea who he was. And at that time, you know, he's about 65 years old. You know, you can still find it at that stage. But the point was, he wasn't him. He was the position that he held. And then when he retired, he was completely and totally lost. And I like basically the idea of take a look at it early on. Take a look at it when you're in your 20s, your 30s, even if you're 40, 50. But the point is look at it. The minute you lose yourself, it could be, and I'll say it again, a lifetime before you can recapture. And sometimes it's too late.
Well, and the problem is we identify so much in the roles that we play that we forget that it's the qualities that we have that make us good at our roles. And what happens is all of our roles that we currently have are with certainty going to end. And I was talking to my husband the other day, and we were like, do you realize that one of us are going to outlive the other? And so all of the roles that we have in our lives will change. And so if we play so heavily in the role that we have, like I did with my professional career, you feel like when that role goes away, that all of a sudden you're only half a person.
Yeah.
And it's a very risky thing for you to deal with change when you're also dealing with the fact that you feel like there is a part of you that's missing when those roles change.
There's a great method for not necessarily finding out who you are, but there's a great method of becoming who you want to be. You project yourself out 15, 20, 25 years ahead, and you're at a dinner party, and they're there honoring you. And you write down everything you'd like them to say about you. Now you got 15, 20, 25 years to become that person. That's really what the key is. And if you don't know who you are, it's really time to get a little confused, get a little scared, go through all the things that you're going to go through. But the end result, the prize at the end of the rainbow, is priceless.
Exactly. And if you think of where you are in 15 to 20 years, but you think of it in terms of how grateful you are to be in that position and really feel of gratitude for all of the things that have lined up between those 15 years from now and those 15 years, it's a very powerful thing to think in terms of it already happening and to feel as if everything that you've, you know, in terms of it's just a goal right now, if you feel that they're already accomplished, it's a very powerful thing for having a lot of this stuff manifest for you.
Now, by the way, are you teaching the kids this?
I am. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of times, a lot of the issues that we have, you know, I believe we're born with inspiration and that, you know, anything is possible and everyone's born to think that way. And along the way, something happens, life happens, and then you have, you know, you kind of pick up self-doubt and uncertainty and a feeling of being the sacrificial lamb in certain chapters in your life. And with my own children, a lot of times we don't actually, you know, we have a great opportunity to really start to define these ideas in them so that they have a more stronger foundation for them going forward, so that when they are reaching their, you know, the different chapters in their life, they will be identifying with the qualities that they have and not the roles that they play, which is extremely important.
That word is important, to identify with. And that's a key. Most people run through life and they don't identify with anything. And there's a lot of pain that goes on with it that shouldn't have to happen. But what you need is somebody that, quote unquote, if I say this 5 times a day or 1,000 times a day, sometimes you need somebody to look over your shoulder and look at your life through different eyes and see what you don't see. And I got a feeling that the girl I used to know, that's what that is inside. So if somebody reads it, and it doesn't really have to, it could be the boy I used to know. It could be for either side, either gender. It really doesn't matter because the story's the same.
Right. Yeah, the little girl or the little boy is the person that, you know, a lot of times we'll think of a situation or a defining moment that was something negative that kind of changed our perspective on things. But if we back it up to be, you know, the day before that event or the day before, the year before, and you remember yourself as a small child, happy and you know, thinking that, you know, life was just fantastic. There was nothing wrong with anything or anyone or yourself. And when you think back to that little person, a lot of times they would have messages for you. You may think, wow, if I think back to that person, I was so involved in something creative or something that was really stood out if someone were to describe you as a child, but you've kind of lost that sort of quality or that identity as you get older and sort of swayed or pushed with the ebb and flow of situation and life. And a lot of times if you go back to that little person, they would be able to, if you had a conversation with them, they'd be able to tell you what your deepest natural skill is, your biggest interest, or an activity that you would love to work on and lose all track of time with.
We're just about out of time. Website we can find you at, Marla?
Yes, it's www.inspireempire.com. And my book is available on Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble, and you can also get it on my website as well. The website has some interesting articles on it as well, if you're interested, and would love to hear about you if you actually do read the book and want to give me some feedback. That would be wonderful.
Okay, and could we sign up for the workshops?
Yes. There is a list of workshops on the website, and more will be coming on in the next few weeks. And I have them in about 5 cities right now in the U.S. and in Canada.
Great. Marla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing now.
Thank you for listening, and if you're listening on the web, which I know you are, tell your local radio stations about the show. That's the way we grow, and that's what you call networking. And that, my friends, is a wrap.